We're going to have questions from the audience, so if you could just make organized lines. And we're going to be taking 3 questions each, if that's okay, and then the panel can answer. If you could also just identify yourself with your name, organization, and keep a comment or question very brief.
Boston College, I'll be doing a Fulbright in Jordan. And this is for Joe, just because I went to Boston College. I took a class in African conflicts, and our professor emailed Boston Globe several times, why is Africa not being covered? And finally, after a while of not getting responses, we got a response saying, people in Boston just didn't care about Africa. They don't want to read about it. And so in Intro to International Relations 101 class, we were told, if you read other languages, don't read American press. If you only read English, read British press. And if you must read an American newspaper, only read the New York Times. And if this is a media lecture and town hall meeting, that's really sad to be told by an American professor to not read American media. And I please would like you to address those issues.
First, I want to say it's the first time I've ever heard Shakespeare and Frank Sinatra in the same sentence.
Well,
second of
name
all,
recognition. Yeah. Name recognition.
I think, I think you could understand from my remarks earlier that I'm not here to defend the United States media or the American press. However, as far as the Globe goes, I know that they have a correspondent in South Africa, John Donnelly, and he used to be at the State Department correspondent. I worked on many stories with him. So I started working for the Globe in June 99. And I've done numerous stories on Africa for the Boston Globe, based at the UN, working with him in the State Department. And then they also had, I can't remember his name right now, they had a stringer there before, and I did a lot of stories on him. I've written about Liberia and Central Africa. And so I think, in fact, at the time, under the previous foreign editor, there was a very strong effort to cover Africa a lot, as much as any American newspaper. And they sent a staff. They had a stringer there, and they've sent Donnelly, who was a staff reporter in the State Department, to cover. AIDS was a big issue for them. They won a Pulitzer for it. So I'm not quite sure. I know I can't tell you how much they have recently covered, but I know that a couple of years ago they were doing a lot of it, and I can't believe anybody at the Globe would write back and say nobody in Boston cares about Africa. I don't know who that person was who wrote that to you, but it just, even if it were true, they wouldn't write that to you. They wouldn't. And it's not, I don't think it is true. Again, I'm not here to defend the Boston Globe. I'm a freelance correspondent for them, but they have covered Africa, and I myself have written many stories about Africa. Now, the other thing about, oh, the New York Times should be the only paper to read. Well, Laura was saying before about we don't need just one paper, so I don't think that's a good advice either, frankly.
I want to ask you about the diction of the war on terror. Retired Marine Corps General Anthony Zinni has said that us declaring war on terror was a mistake because terror is a tactic. The analogy he uses was, well, that would be akin to Roosevelt declaring war on kamikazes or Wilson declaring war on U-boats. Now, my question is, presuming that we misframed the war on terror, what would you reframe it as? Do you think, and you spoke, you alluded to the fact that whenever anything happens with terrorism, the only terror organization that people are aware of in the public is Al-Qaeda. So everything comes back to Al-Qaeda. People still think Saddam Hussein was probably running Al-Qaeda. Now, I mean, should we have framed this, can we reframe this as a war against militant Islamic fascism? Can we isolate the wing of Islam that is perverting how would you go about that? And do you think that a mistake was made in calling it the war on terror in the first place?
Thank you. We'll take one more from here, and then we'll...
Okay.
Yeah.
My question actually has elements of the question that was just asked. And this is for anybody on the panel who's willing to entertain it. Between the panel this morning and the panel this afternoon, I noticed a common message. One of the speakers this morning said that he appealed to our common humanity as a basis from which to begin to understand each other. Another one said, I believe in trying to understand one another. And Mr. Loria here today, this afternoon, I believe he said that in order for a reporter to do his job well, reporting from another country, he has to put himself in the shoes of the people of that country. In the last 5-6 years, where I started to become aware of global issues, I've spoken with a lot of people from different cultures than my own, speaking different languages and different ideologies. And it seems to me that, and from watching the media and reading the news, that the psychology of those who are more moderate, the characteristics that come to the fore seem to be that their fundamental basis is one of balance. They're non-forceful and they're non-imposing on another person's point of views. Instead, they express and they give the other person the right to also express their point of view. And where they're wrong, they admit that they're wrong. On the other side, the extremists are always forceful. Their passion is also seems to have gone awry in that they're coming from a place of fear and anger. And they force their views and they're imposing on others. And I've seen this, for example, say from the cleric that preaches after the Friday prayers, to the videos that are shown on Al Jazeera, to the people on the Fox News channel. So I'm wondering, first as an individual, how does one go about dealing if you claim to be moderate, or what makes more sense to me is to be a moderate, to express yourself where the stage is inherently given to those who are on either extreme because they are more outspoken and they're more forceful in their way.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I'll take a little bit of the interview. As far as the war on terror is concerned, even in the Islamic world, when in the aftermath of 9/11 attacks in the United States, everybody basically supported that the United States should take revenge from the Taliban and so forth and go to Afghanistan. That's not the point. The point is that I went to Pentagon and asked this question of Paul Wolfowitz. I said, Mr. Wolfowitz, once when the United States decided to attack Afghanistan in order to get rid of these Talibans who are spreading this hate against the Western world and who are aiding Al-Qaeda to gain a foothold over there. I said, everybody in the Muslim world was with you. In fact, when I went back to Pakistan, I heard Pakistanis said, why don't we take care of some of the extremists over here? And then you decided to turn around and put all the Al-Qaeda who were never there in Iraq, in Iraq, and then suddenly that war was totally, the terror war turned around. There was no Al-Qaeda connection to Saddam Hussein or the weapons of mass destruction. And once you did that, you lost all support amongst the Muslim world. Of course, he took issue with that. But the fact is, the war on terror had a support initially, but once the United States went into Iraq, the whole Muslim world turned against the United States, and that is one thing that they can't understand. The thing is, if you warp this thing to this whole war on terror in order to, for your own means, political means, or in this particular case, what people said, in order to gain control of Middle East oil, in order to gain control of Middle East per se, then the whole thing falls apart. And that is one of the reasons why I believe this war on terror, which has been lost at this point in time by the United States, only because of the fact that they lost sight of the real goal and they decided to go into Middle East for reasons other than fighting terrorism. So that is one thing which has really, really undermined this war. So that is what the gentleman over there has to say, and I did not hear, could hear anybody who said that.
I just want to go back to actually to the very first question, since you all are students. It is very correct that you should read a number of newspapers if you speak read another language. I highly suggest that you look at Le Monde and not necessarily the reporting, the world reporting, but look at the opinion pages, because the opinion pages, if you look at different magazines and newspapers throughout the world, is something so you can get an idea of what people are thinking of. One of my friends runs, I believe this is the right, it's www.mideastwire.org. It's one of the few websites, I think you can get a trial subscription for free, and then unfortunately it's a subscriber, but it's fairly, it's a fairly small fee. And what they do is they translate Arab newspapers throughout the Arab world, plus they translate Hebrew newspapers or newspapers in Israel, and they do a very even-handed translation, and it's a very valuable tool. It's something that I use a lot, and I highly suggest that you do that. Yes, BBC is good. They make mistakes, but they are one of my favorites. But yes, you should read other newspapers outside of the United States. If you have to read newspapers in the United States, you should read, I suggest you read Los Angeles Times. Their world reporting is very good, their A section, and also the San Francisco Chronicle. They have a lot of reporters throughout the world. They're not just like one person in Paris who writes about everything from Oceania to, you know, Antarctica. So I suggest those two as well.
Just a comment on the person that asked about the issue of being a moderate. I think I speak from my own perspective in the church, because we have our own fights at the moment. Some of you will have read about sexuality and women bishops and various other things. One of the things about being a moderate is you'll never be popular. People don't come rushing to you asking for your opinion when you're a moderate, when you're a peacemaker, because it doesn't make news. So you've got to work on how you're going to work as a moderate, as someone building relationships and not trying to destroy them or to be an extremist. How do you work at a grassroots level to convince other people of your cause to join you in that moderate place? Because that's what really matters. And one of the things that struck me as I was listening, the Episcopal Church had its general convention 2 weeks ago, and the press covered a lot about our new woman presiding bishop and about sexuality. But the key focus of the convention was the Millennium Development Goals. That's where the moderates were. We were talking about that. We were taking action. We were voting to give 0.7% of our budget as a national church, as dioceses, as individuals, to work towards the Millennium Development Goals. That stuff isn't going to always make the press, but it doesn't make it any less important to be talking about it and working for it.
Yes, thank you. If I could just add another dimension to the two questions raised, which are very important, the press and terrorism. One, the press, I was alluding to values in journalism. If we could get just to the basic values that go a long way in getting to the truth. If we can separate facts from opinion and not mix them, that'll be very important and very helpful. It's already difficult to work with facts. You can, with bricks, build a railroad or highway, or you can build a palace. That's the difference. When you add your opinion and you mix it with the facts, then people do not necessarily get the truths or the factual situations. So many people just mix facts with opinion. As to terrorism, whether it should be called fight against terrorism or something else is also very important questions. But I would like to remind you that terrorism didn't start on 9/11. One, we have had terrorism for many, many years and many decades. Terrorism that came out of 9/11 is most recent, but we forget that there is violence and terrorism in other countries, in Colombia, in Ireland, in Uganda, in Burundi, in many African countries, Asian countries. So what do we call that? Should we call it fight against terrorism or simply fight against violence? No matter what the name is, it is not acceptable. And the question is, how do you vanquish this terrorism? By simply answering with more violence, or by going to the deep root causes of the violence and terrorism? And deep causes are very deep, and they require a lot of not only thinking, but a lot of financing. There is no doubt that to a large extent terrorism is bred by social conditions, by poverty, by lack of opportunities, and we should address those causes. Thank you.
Great. We'll take three more questions starting from here.
Some of you have been singing the praises, so to speak, of the New York Times. And while I'm not here to sort of dwell on the mistakes that the Times has made in the past, I was wondering what you could, if you would comment on, you know, the quoting of anonymous government officials and just repeating what they have to say by people such as Judy Miller, and similarly, sensationalizing stories such as the Toronto arrests that were made based on a sting operation conducted by a Canadian government for fertilizer that was never actually sold. And what do you think about, you know, the rise of alternative media such as, you know, blogs and internet sites and sort of maybe serving as a stopgap solution to this kind of problem, I would say?
Great, thank you.
Okay. Why is there such a disparity in news coverage when it comes to Americans or Israelis? When, like, if one American dies or one American is kept hostage, it's all every news channel 24/7. On the other hand, if 200 Iraqis die, or Pakistanis, or Palestinians, or other nationalities, they vanquish or they're held hostage, it's not giving enough, you know, attention. Am I naive in saying that the American media holds American lives or Israeli lives to a higher pedestal? Or, you know, is it just my... I'm just, you know, disillusioned.
Thanks, and we'll take one more.
Okay.
Just one more, sorry.
Three.
Okay. Okay, this is a learning event. I hope we're all learning from each other. And I hope no one get offended, you know, like we're not get offended by any of the remarks made. I just had a quick remark before I say my question is, I'm joining the call of Mr. Paul Findlay, who was like an ex-20-year congressman, who in his book, Silent No More, Confronting America's False Stereotypes of Islam, he calls for the best way to communicate with a Muslim is to start with pronouncing Islam in the right way. Islam, it is Islam. It is not Islam, or it's not with a Z, it's with an S. So this is very important, and he states that. I think this is, I mean, we're a communication event, and this is important to be very frank and honest about all these points. Maybe this side point for some people, but it is a point to be put into consideration. My question is, with the intention of Al Jazeera to open an English section, an English satellite channel, how would that change the reporting methods and how the media, the global media, maybe the U.S. media in particular will report the events and what my colleague was saying now, how they get reported, how would that have an effect? Thank you very much. Thank you. So we have the rise of alternative media and the question of Al Jazeera, English, and American lives versus others?
Yeah. No, basically, I should first of all address the question about the New York Times and so, because I had also said something. You're absolutely right when you said that New York Times was complicit when we went to war in Iraq. Actually, the whole American media, which was supposed to be so unbiased and so above the board, became totally complicit with the Bush administration in not opposing the war in Iraq, and they believed the story being fed to them by the administration in order to make a case to the American public that the war is necessary in order to get Saddam Hussein out, because he had weapons of mass destruction, which was totally untrue. And I also want to say, yes, you're absolutely right. When it comes down to how many Iraqis have died? At this time, I think, in my estimation, the way things are going, they say 100,000. I think about 300,000 or 400,000 Iraqis have died. But that doesn't move anybody. But look at what's happening in Palestine now. For one soldier, Israel has launched this war in Palestine, right? And in order to get back that soldier whom was taken alive, they have got some four or five of their own soldiers killed, 50 to about 60 Palestinian killed, but their reply is so inordinate. So, of course, the Muslims feel our lives are totally useless. Only the lives which matter are the American lives and Israeli lives, and that does create a problem in the Muslim world. It does create a problem because they feel, okay, we are third-class citizens of this world. We are less equal. These people are more equal. And of course, as far as that is concerned, there should be alternative media. And as I was saying, that in a country like Pakistan, everybody thinks, oh, Pakistan, there must be a whole bunch of terrorists. If somebody goes to Pakistan, you will see I mean, that those people over there, you would be totally bowled over how liberal the Pakistanis are. Every time there's been an election, they've always voted for the moderate people. They've always voted for people like Benazir Bhutto or anybody who promises them, social reforms. Reforms they can get jobs, they can get change their lives. So that is the case. And we haven't seen the other part of the Muslim world, like in Indonesia and so forth. They're much more liberal people in Indonesia. In Muslim world does not only mean Saudi Arabia and, I mean, I'm not running down Saudi Arabia, please. I'm not talking about that, but the stereotypes. Oh, all Muslims are terrorists and everybody else, we are good. That's the point. That particular stereotype has to be shed. And I'm sure my colleagues over here have to say something. Go ahead.
I just want to just make it quick, because I know there's a lot of people who have questions. Just touch on a few things. First of all, the rise of alternative media, love it. I think it's fabulous. I think the one thing that you need to understand, though, blogs are wonderful. Blogs are fabulous. I read many blogs. However, you need to put on your critical thinking cap and understand that some of the people, they do have a certain message that they are trying to put across, and it's not necessarily one that maybe they'll say, oh, yes, many people think this. Well, you know, use critical thinking when you read this stuff, because too much information in a blog can sometimes, you know, be very critical when you read. I agree that, you know, American, when they say, oh yeah, this American guy died, this Israeli guy died, and then they list his name, and they say, oh yeah, and like 30 other, you know, Pakistanis or 10, Antarcticans or whatever. You know, it's ridiculous. When I was in journalism school, we used to have to do these exercises, and I would always put 10 Pakistanis, 10 Antarcticans, and then at the end I'd put, oh yeah, and there were some Americans, and I would get in trouble for that. And they always said, you know, you need to be balanced. But in the big bad world in the United States, they are always trying to target, you know, the U.S. audience, because unfortunately they think Americans are going to get bored if you read about somebody else dying, which I still have a problem with. And in my reporting, although I report at the UN, and hopefully nobody's going to die in the UN anytime soon, so I won't have to write that, but that is something that I definitely have a problem with.
Joe? Yeah, about Judy Miller. You know, the European press, generally, when you pick one up, you kind of know what their political line is, not just from the editorial, but from the reporting. The Guardian is a left-leaning newspaper. Political parties in Italy published their own newspapers. You knew you were getting the right of centers, and you knew they were more openly biased. You knew where they were coming from. You knew what you were getting. American papers supposedly are objective. If they have agendas, they're hidden, and I think Judy Miller is a perfect example. Nobody knows what her politics were. We had Giuliana Scagna, the Italian journalist who was shot when she was released from captivity in Baghdad. We had her at the UN a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, she's a communist, and you know where she's coming from. But Judy Miller, what is her politics? We don't know, except she was out on the field dressed in a military uniform telling American generals where the WMDs were. And when this colonel, well, they said, well, I don't really want to talk to you because you're, what do you know? She's had a general friend of hers call him up. They had to go looking, and they didn't find them, as we know. So, you know, the thing about, somebody mentioned about just taking out the handouts from the government officials. It goes back to what I was talking about, to the long history in 1953, overthrow of Mossadegh. And I just want to say the journalists back then followed the lead of official Washington, opted for simple themes that matched Western conceptions of Middle Eastern peoples and neatly fit within the context of the Cold War at the time, which was that Mossadegh was portrayed as a communist. He was not. He was a nationalist. He didn't want any outside interference in his country. Now, what a novel idea. I mean, we don't want black people don't want Mexicans coming over to work in a restaurant. But we can go and invade a country and interfere in their internal affairs. You know, as a result, Mossadegh, at his political end, appeared in the press as a highly irrational and discredited leader, a portrayal that could not help but serve the purposes of those who had planned the coup. If you're going to overthrow somebody, you got to demonize him. Start with Saddam, who was a CIA asset before, as Osama bin Laden was. Mossadegh had to be demonized. He was elected. And the issue was economic, openly. It was the nationalization of oil by the United, by his party, even before he came to power in 1951. And this, the British had owned Anglo-Iranian oil. And after the war, they wanted to, the U.S. went in there, tried to get their own oil companies in there. And so there was a rivalry between Britain and the U.S. But once it was nationalized, the U.S. went over with the Brits. They formed together a plan to overthrow the guy. Time magazine, back to how the press portrayed it, made him man of the year in 1951. And as this book explains, they had to, Time magazine continuously has to explain that man of the year doesn't mean they approve of the guy. It's just he's the most newsworthy person of the year. They described him as a dizzy old wizard who put Scheherazade in the petroleum business and oiled the wheels of chaos, etc. And they placed his, there was no attempt by the press to place his antics, including bouts of weeping, press conferences conducted while he was wearing pajamas, and an outburst of temper in the context that such behavior was seen as acceptable in a culture in which public displays of emotions is perfectly normal. If Americans had known more of Iranian history, they might have better appreciated why Iranians enjoyed so much the posturing of Mossadegh, and that his actions were interpreted as an expression of self-assertion and confronting the outside forces which for years had interfered in the affairs of the country. Again, a lack of understanding of the peoples that are covered, the demonization of a leader that has to be overthrown. The U.S. press works hand in hand with official Washington policy, unfortunately. I don't see that ever ending. I just don't.
Are you going to talk?
Thank you. Again, coming as the last one, I have only to sweep the floor. The question asked by the gentleman over here about alternative press is very crucial and very important. It's up to us now. The implication of the question is whether we have a diversity of news, and we do, and I say a word about it. Alternative media is important, but it has very limited coverage and has limited audience. If one day it will gain more audience, that will be terrific. But until then, we have to be satisfied with something else. And something else is established press, established media, plus the small alternative sources. But you know, as well as I know, that you have in your hands now, in your possibilities, I mean, in front of you, the possibility of reading the world newspapers. How many of you do that? I would like to see how many hands are in. How many of you go through world press? Not too many. So, not that it is meant to be criticism. Students are very, very busy. Intellectuals are busy. Scholars are busy. But we now have the possibility through the internet to read practically every newspaper, every magazine in the world in English. And if you know some other languages, be it French or Arabic or Spanish, you can read the entire world. So the choice is already there, but we don't make use of it because of limited time, because of other responsibilities and engagement. So it devolves then to the journalists, to the correspondents, to filter out this news in the most honest way and present it to the public. And it is the mediocrity of the coverage that is the problem today.
I didn't want to hog the mic, but nobody addressed AJI, so I'm going to do it really quickly. Al Jazeera International, I happen to know the UN correspondents at Al Jazeera and also at Al Jazeera International. And I think that you'll be happy with the coverage. I mean, based on they haven't started yet. I mean, they've already started reporting. And I know that the UN correspondents, I don't know if I should say this, but they've already been to Haiti and did a lot of reporting there, and they're going to put out a program when they come out. That's probably going to be their first week, one of their first shows. That's the first thing. Also, FYI, they're hiring in Washington, D.C., and they're also looking for Arab Americans. That's a plus. And also other people, you know, they're equal opportunity. But, something to think about.
Thank you. Okay, we are actually running short on time, so we're going to take two more questions, and I believe these are the last.
My question is, what, if any, do you see as the practical steps that could be taken towards bringing more balance and more honesty and more openness into the American media? I know that we've addressed that there's lots of alternative media now, that if people choose to, there's lots of world media that they could read, but it kind of goes back to what the majority of the country reads and sees, and if there are any practical steps that you see that can be taken.
I just have a quick statement. As a journalist, I challenge the American media to improve the relationship between the West and Muslims and Islam, to stop attaching Islam to acts of terror and violence. When a person who happens to be a radical Christian or Jew bombs an abortion clinic or a gay nightclub, you don't see their religion attached to that act of violence in the newspaper. The second thing is that Islam is not just the Arab world. Arabs make up only 10% of the Muslim world. A lot of Muslims come from the Asian continent, Africa, Latin America, here in North America, and other parts of the world. To report on other diverse parts of the Muslim world besides just the Arab world, and report on the positive lifestyles of Muslim women and not just oppressed women wearing black in other countries. And also to report positively on Hajj and Ramadan. I've never seen Hajj positively covered here in America. The only thing I see Hajj covered about is the latest tent fire or a stampede around the Kaaba. The only time I've heard Hajj covered positively is in CNN International when I happened to be in Ghana, West Africa during the Hajj season, and I saw the most beautiful coverage of Hajj and how diverse it was and how everyone met people of other races and ethnicities while in Saudi. But I've never seen that covered here in America. Thank you.
I'd like to respond to that. Can I?
Yeah.
I don't think that the U.S. government and the U.S. press is anti-Muslim. I don't think they're overtly anti-Muslim. I don't think it's an issue of that because they're friendly with Saudi Arabia. They're friendly with the Pakistanis. They have been during the Cold War and now. It's about oil. They happen to a lot of Muslim people have been living on top of oil and during the Cold War in a strategic area that the Russians were interested in. And other interests, not just oil. So Mubarak is another one in Egypt. The issue is not Muslim so much. It just happens to be, you know, you're living in the wrong place. We need that oil here. Come on.
I think Mr. Abadi should go next. I don't want him to sweep the floor, so I want him to go next.
I didn't hear what you
said. I said, I don't want you to sweep the floor. Go next.
Thank you. I give you back that right.
Go ahead. Okay, I'll go. I'll hog the floor.
No comment.
It's my routine, about 20 minutes.
I'll hog. There is, Laura Angelo was trying to justify that this, Mr. Abadi should speak more, and the citizens should speak more than I do. But in any case, what I'm saying is, one of the things that I've noticed, the BBCs and CNN, which did have an influence, that have now started to waning. There's a waning influence because in lots of countries, lots of medias are coming out. The local medias are dominating. BBC and CNN and things like that do not have the same hold anymore. I mean, you and give you the example of Pakistan. Pakistan, we used to have. Everybody believed BBC as a gospel truth. No longer. We have over there GEO, we have over there ARY, we have over there so many other channels which are now alternative to this and which are doing a great job. Same thing in India and other countries, that's what's happening. So basically, and that there is no... the power of BBC and CNN is now waning, but now, of course... In the United States, the power of CNN cannot be undermined, and not in the New York Times, that we realize. And in order for the alternate media to establish itself over here is a difficult job. And I also want to talk about the perception. Basically, it all comes down to perception. Like, for instance, if you are a Muslim, you are extremist immediately. When I was recently on a trip with the State Department talking to people about reaching out and so forth. When I told them that I was married to an American who was a Christian, who was a Catholic, and we got married in a church, and they said, okay, so when you took her to Pakistan, didn't your parents throw you out? No. Basically, I mean, the thing is, this is what the perception is, that Muslims are totally, and that somehow has not shed as yet. No matter what you do, there are so many of us, I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one. There's so many other Muslims over here who have reached out, who are moderates who have compromised. So that thing has to be done. I mean, we haven't been able to do it. And there are so many things that the Muslims themselves should be blamed for, because we cannot keep on blaming the Western media for everything. We have to intellectualize and ourselves decide as to what is it that we are doing wrong. The Muslims are doing it, and we should pinpoint that and try and formulate some sort of a policy to go forth.
Now I'm really going to sweep the floor. No, I really don't want to get out of this wonderful session in an optimist, in a pessimist mood. I'm an optimist. I always say that because at the UN they pay us to be optimist. But my friends, this kind of audience, this kind of workshops or speeches is very important in illuminating certain issues. But we must not forget there are things going out there, just beginning, that people all over the world are trying to resolve the very same problems we are talking about now. Let me give you an example. Not long ago, about a month ago, we had a gathering like this between some professionals, and it was during the time when the Prophet Muhammad was depicted, caricatured, etc., and the tension was high, and there were demonstrations all over the world, and my friend, a gentleman who is of Jewish faith, looked at me and he said, I am very pessimistic and nothing is going to work from now on. And I said, I don't think so. And so he looked at me and he said, you have been at the United Nations for too long. And it's true, I've been there 40 years, more than Kofi Annan.
Not as a journalist, but he has been an insider.
And so I said, well, we will see in 2 or 3 months who is right. And you know what happened. Things calmed down. We don't hear any more demonstrations in Indonesia or Pakistan about the caricatures of Prophet. Now when he looks at me, he says, next time I'll be careful. I said, your pessimism has colored your views. So, there are many things happening in the world. I mentioned one, the Alliance of Civilization. This is a group appointed the highest level by the world community to look into these questions of dialogue among civilizations. Because, as I said, it's not just a question of today's press or today's current affairs. It's history, it's culture, it's understanding between people. And that's much deeper, if they can get to the roots of that. There are dialogues going on among the three major faiths. They just held one in Spain, between Judaism, Christianity, and the Muslim world. So, we should not be pessimist, because beyond the press, what we read today, and there is no reason not to be pessimist when you read the press or hear the television, there are communities all over the world that for the first time are beginning to deal with the questions. Let me give you just another example and I'll stop. There are communities now, there are certain countries who are going to mosque and saying to the imams, if you preach hatred or intolerance, you will be sanctioned. And they are taking measures. You don't read about these things, but they are out there. So I would like to end on that optimistic side, because they pay us to be optimists.
Just on the practical thing about what you can do, when you leave here, when you go back to wherever you're going back to, and you're going to organize meetings and town meetings and talk to people, make sure you invite your local press. They may not come the first time, but the fifth or sixth time, they'll get to know you and they'll want to come. And then when you've got them there, make sure you have worked out what's the one thing you want to say, because that's what they're going to report. If you only give them one thing to say, they're going to report that. It's logic. So work out what the most important thing is that you want to say, that you want to get out in your local press. I know our county newspaper comes by my church once a month, I guess, for something or other, just because they know they can get a story out of us. So develop those relationships and work out what you want to say and just say it.
I just have one really quick thing on the practical as well. I know this is going to sound like really cheese ball, like hold hands around the campfire, but letters to the editor really help. They do read those letters. Also, panels like this also help too, because we hear what you guys have to say. But I highly recommend letters to the editor. And blogs... Yes, I know it. There's positive and negative, but you know, people read them and editors read them. And, there's been editorial content meetings that have changed because people said, have you read this blog? That have gained credibility. So, I think that, but letters to the editor, I really, really highly recommend. That's about all I can say.
Great. Just to say, the answer is Karen Hughes. Somebody mentioned Karen Hughes. Send a Texan woman out there and tell the Muslims all about how America is, really loves them. I think that's complete contemptuousness of the U.S. government to Islamic peoples, because I think they should have a little more respect for their intelligence than to send a woman like that out there. Even though I said there's no overt racism, I don't think there is, and there's a policy, but when there's trouble in a country and an operation needs to be done, you don't want the people against you, so you try some kind of propaganda like that. It's pitiful.
Right. Great. And on that note, let's thank our panel. And as we wrap up, I guess you know you have a lot on your minds, you have a lot on your plates, there's much to be done, and you know, it's been an excellent experience, you know, organizing this and speaking to a lot of you. A lot of you have expressed enthusiasm to do such things in the future. Right on, please keep it up, do something like this. Take heed to what the panels have been talking about. I hope the networking that you've done amongst yourselves has been useful, and I just want to say some quick thank yous. This could not have been possible without the support of the Political Science Department here at the Graduate Center, and by a generous grant from the Doctoral Students Council, which is the student government here at the Graduate Center. And a great big thank you to all the Americans for Informed Democracy interns and volunteers. Could you please stand up, please? You guys deserve a big thank you. So, good job. And on that note, thank you from me. It's been a wonderful experience. Please do this. I hope I've passed the torch on somehow. That's all I can do. Thanks.